This podcast is sponsored by WorthPoint. Find out what your antiques are worth at worthpoint.com. All right, I'm with Jim Craig, and we're here to talk about John Haley Bellamy. How are you doing, Jim?
Doing great. Yourself, Martin?
Great, great. Thanks so much for joining us. This is a great subject for me. I really enjoy Bellamy's work. First of all, let's talk about the exhibition that's going to be in Portsmouth, New Hampshire.
Yep.
And what's it called?
The name of the exhibition is Bold and Brash, The Art of John Haley Bellamy. Opens on April 4th. Up there in Portsmouth. It's being held at Discover Portsmouth.
And where is that exactly in Portsmouth?
It's right down the street from the center of town. Market Square is the center of town. It's the old public library.
Oh, yes, of course. It's a beautiful building.
Yeah, it's a gorgeous old federal structure.
Yes.
Two full floors. And that's where it's going to be held, right on Middle Street.
Yep.
And parking right across the street. Couldn't ask for a better location.
Yes, it's a great place. Yeah.
And the exhibition is going to open on April 4th, and it runs all the way until the end of September.
How many actual Bellamy pieces are going to be on that exhibition?
We are having well over 100 pieces by Bellamy. This is going to be the largest gathering of Bellamy's artwork under one roof ever. So this is a major retrospective that we're putting on, filling up both floors of the Discover Portsmouth Center. And we're covering every facet of his career. Everything from his first drawing when he was a wee lad, his charming piece called The Flying Dragon, absolutely gorgeous, all the way to the very last wood carving that he ever is known to have executed back in 1912.
Wow.
So, and full gamut.
That's amazing. You're an author, and you wrote a book, and it's a similar name to the exhibition. Can you?
The book is titled American Eagle, The Bold Art and Brash Life of John Haley Bellamy. It's being published by the Portsmouth Marine Society. It is the new definitive biography on John Haley Bellamy, over 200 pages and full color, and the latest, most cutting-edge research on the man. It tips a lot of sacred cows. A lot of things we thought we knew about Bellamy that we now know aren't quite the case, or things that were just dead wrong.
Yeah.
So it kind of reads almost like a detective novel, actually.
Oh, well, that's great, because I know the book that was written about him several years ago wasn't all that accurate from what I understand. Let's talk about who Bellamy was for the listener so they can understand this conversation. I think of the carved Bellamy eagles, the beautiful work. But let's talk about John Haley Bellamy. I know he was born and raised and grew up and carved in Kittery Point, Maine, and worldwide fame for his beautiful carvings.
Yeah, well, Bellamy's story begins on April 16th in the year 1836. He was born in Kittery Point, Maine, which is a tiny little hamlet that's part of Kittery, Maine, which is the southernmost town in all of the state of Maine. His childhood, fairly typical for a kid growing up in that neck of the woods at the time. Kittery was a township that was very heavily centered on the sea. Lots of shipbuilding going on there, commercial shipbuilding, lots of commercial activity, shipping everything from lumber and tin to more exotic goods being brought up from the West Indies and in the coastal trades.
And then the Navy Yard right around the corner.
And that was where I was going next.
Yes,
of course, right a stone's throw from his house is the Portsmouth Navy Yard, which is actually in Kittery.
Yeah. They're still debating that over the years, whether it's in Maine or
I'm not getting involved in that one. I've had locals on both sides. They have very strong opinions.
Yeah.
But when it comes to that Navy Yard, that was the prime employer in town at the time. This is where a lot of America's warships are being built and repaired. Those ships are, of course, made out of wood. So Bellamy's growing up in a town stuffed to the gills with wood carvers and woodworkers. So it's no surprise, really, he would gravitate to wood carving. And that is where he would make his career.
Did he have any influence, like a family influence at all?
Oh, I'm glad you asked that. In fact, his father.
Huh.
His father is the Honorable Charles Gerrish Bellamy. He was a dynamo in Maine politics, served in a wide array of public offices. The highlight of his career was when he came within one vote of gaining the Democratic nomination to run for the U.S. Senate from Maine. So very powerful, connected man. But the funny thing is, before he ever went into politics, Charles Gerrish Bellamy was an expert woodcarver. He had studied civic architecture and engineering down in Boston. There's many a house still standing in Kittery today that was actually built by him.
John actually start carving with his father at one point?
It seems to be the case. Mm-hmm. Bellamy's growing up in a family full of woodcarvers. Not only is his father a master woodcarver, but so are Bellamy's younger brothers, Charles Jr. and Elisha. So all the males in the family are woodcarving. The father seems to have been the one who kindled the interest in them, who taught them the rudimentary basics.
Mm-hmm.
I should also mention that his father was also the U.S. Inspector of Timber at the Portsmouth and Charlestown, Massachusetts Navy Yards.
Wow.
And he also ran the boat building shops in those two Navy Yards. So he's involved in naval architecture. He built the first bridge that ever spanned the Piscataqua River. Bellamy's dad knows his wood very well. And he's the seed. He plants the seed that would eventually turn into this amazing wood carver.
Yeah. Yep. Now, for the listener out there that's just getting into this whole conversation here, what makes a Bellamy Eagle so special?
Oh, where to begin? A Bellamy Eagle, first of all, I think it's just the pure aesthetics of the bird.
Mm-hmm.
Every artist before Bellamy who's trying to carve the American Eagle, they really focus in on this very ponderous detail. They try to capture every feather, every wrinkle, every crease of the talons. They're trying for photographic realism. And in the process, it becomes so ponderous, so baroque, that these eagle carvings, even by greats like Samuel McIntyre, they don't look like a bird. Bellamy streamlines the American Eagle. He breaks it down to its most basic components. He's actually a precursor to the modern art and abstract art that we would see coming in the next century. So in that way, he's a pioneer. By streamlining the eagle down to its most basic attributes, by just having, it's only four pieces. A typical Bellamy Eagle, it has a wing assembly, which is just 1 2-foot wide slice of pine with a shield and some feathering. And then, of course, you have the head and neck assembly, which has this graceful swoop, usually pointing in an upward direction.
Mm-hmm.
The beak is either has a very sharp 90-degree angle. There are a few that have a more realistic beak, more curved to it. And then you have a banner and a pole with a pike on the end. The banner, of course, has a motto in it. Most commonly, don't give up the ship.
Right.
When it comes to these eagles, they're so streamlined that they're actually more expressive than anything that anyone had ever attempted before him.
Hmm.
So a Bellamy Eagle, when you look at it, it just screams the ebullience, patriotism, the joy of being an American. Hmm. There's also a little bit of fierceness in there as well. Hmm. The thing that really resonates with me is there's enormous optimism in his birds. Like I said, the head is almost always looking upward.
Yep.
Onward.
That's right.
Like the bird is in like the bird is taking off in flight. The bird is looking to the future. So by being so streamlined, they're more expressive, and like I said, they're really a precursor to the abstract art forms that are going to emerge in the coming century.
Yeah. Ever since I was a young kid in this business, the first time I saw a Bellamy Eagle, I wanted one.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had a couple over the years, but the one I hate to admit this, but I have a copy. right now, but it's pleasing, and the reason I have that is because I was in California for 9 years, and I didn't want to be moving around a Bellamy Eagle out there, so I got a copy, and it's still very nice, and it's way up on the wall, and it looks good. Speaking of California, I just wanted to tell you this quick story because I think it's kind of fascinating. I was doing an appraisal clinic out there, and there was about 30 or 40 people in line. It was pretty busy. The woman that was running the lines out there, she came up to me and she said, "We have a carved eagle that was in George Washington's home." And I said, "Really?" I said, "I'm definitely interested in looking at that. Make sure that person comes in my line." So the person came up with this eagle and she unwraps it. And I said, "Well, I have good news and bad news for you." And she said, "Well," I said, "this is years after George Washington died. This is when this was carved." I said, "The good news is it's a Bellamy Eagle." And she goes, "What's that?" And I said, "It's a real nice eagle." But you always hear stories with these eagles. And if George Washington had everything in his house that people think he had, you wouldn't be able to live in a warehouse. Yeah. When was the major body of his work done? In what periods?
Well, that's a tough question. I guess you have to back up first. You have to realize that Bellamy is a carver of several different things. We think of him most as the carver of these beautiful eagle sculptures. His career really begins in 1859 in earnest.
Mm-hmm.
He actually opens up a shop at 17 Daniel Street in Portsmouth.
Mm.
And from a newspaper article I was very fortunate to find, he's mainly doing ship carvings. This is decorative woodwork for commercial ships that are being built in the Portsmouth area at that
time. Are we talking like sternboards and things like that?
Sternboards, cat heads, mm-hmm. and surprisingly, figureheads. This was one of the real big revelations. I know
that beautiful figurehead that was at the... It's in the
Mariner's Museum.
Yes,
down in Newport News.
Yeah.
That's his most famous piece. That's Magnum Opus. It's widely considered to be one of the finest pieces of nautical wood carving in America and the world. And that is, of course, the USS Lancaster Eagle figurehead. Mm-hmm. A little later in his career, funny thing is, everyone always said that was the only figurehead Bellamy ever did. Philip Isaacson was the man who wrote the book on the American Eagle back in during the time of the Bicentennial. Isaacson was adamant about this.
Mm.
No, Bellamy actually carved several figureheads. Most of them, of course, are now lost to us, being a perishable art form. But that's what he's really doing in 1859. He's working for commercial shipbuilders down in Portsmouth. And then he moves to Medford, Massachusetts, and East Boston, Massachusetts. He's briefly working down there. Again, doing ship carvings for the clippers and packet ships that are being built there at the time. Purely decorative work.
Yeah.
So that's one focus of his career. Then you have his career as a carver for the United States Navy.
And about what year was that?
He starts working for the U.S. Navy at the Portsmouth Navy Yard in 1860, and he is going to continue to work for the Navy all the way up until around 1898-1900. The last record of him being on the books for the U.S. Navy is 1898. The records are admittedly spotty. In his obituaries, it states 1900 was the cutoff date.
Mm-hmm.
But again, he's doing decorative wood carving for the Navy.
The thing I just heard you say, which I think is a great phrase, is the perishable art form.
Mm-hmm.
And definitely, you know, a lot of other things you consider like schoolgirl samplers, you know, needlework, textiles, all these things are biodegradable. And when it comes to things like anything to do with a ship or a boat, you're out there in the elements. And exactly. A lot of times, you know, he did Pilot House Eagles too, I imagine, did he?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that he did.
I never really hear too much about them in particular.
Because again, these things easily get destroyed. They're baked by the sun. They're hit by the salt waves, the salt air.
Right.
They were never meant to be cherished. These were ornamental items.
Now, you mentioned earlier figureheads. Did he actually do the female figureheads as well?
Yes, he did.
Uh-huh.
We find in this article, it mentions that he does the bust of a female, an Indian, and an ox.
Wow, an ox?
An ox. Can't imagine what ship that went on.
Must have been a barge.
one could imagine. I mean, these could have, at the time in Portsmouth, they're building everything from clipper ships all the way down to gundalows, which are just these barges with sails on them that go up and down the Piscataqua River and do some coastal trade, too. So it could have ended up on anything. We don't know the dimensions, unfortunately.
Yeah. Now, the one thing that strikes me about Bellamy's carving, and always has, and it's going to be hard to explain, but it's the very precise work of his carving and a very
crisp and bold cuts.
There it is. Yeah. Thank you. Let me say that over here.
And look at enough of these darn sculptures. Yeah, yeah. Well, the shape of the eye itself is kind of like a torpedo, if you will. It's deceptively complex. It looks very simple when you first look at it. It just looks like the head of a bullet or a torpedo. But then when you actually get in there, like you said, the cut is it's with unerring precision. It's very and you don't see any hesitation in there.
That's right.
These things he just goes in there and he just nails it on the first attempt.
Yep.
What you're seeing there is a man who has ample experience. This is an expert wood carver in every way, manner, shape, or form. He is not afraid that he's going to screw it up.
You know, I got to say, in today's world, there are a few people like that. And one of them is an old friend of mine, Artie Swanson.
Yep, Artie Swanson. I am familiar with Artie very well. Yeah. Thank you.
I haven't seen him for about 15 years, but he does beautiful copies of
Artie is a debate I seem to have stumbled upon as to who is the best Bellamy copyist out there.
Uh-huh.
There are two, and I think Artie's a little better. But Artie, in my opinion, is the best.
Yeah, he's been doing them a long time. I remember for at least 25 years, maybe mm-hmm. longer.
He started back in the 70s, I think.
Was it that long?
Yeah, wow. So we're going back to like some 40-odd years now. Artie, originally, he was tasked with brushing up some of these pieces. Like people actually had, remember, it's a perishable art form.
Yeah.
So a lot of people kept their Bellamy Eagles outdoors.
Yes. So, I think there's still one in Rye. Have you driven by the house in Rye, New Hampshire?
I don't know about that one.
Caught that?
I know there's one in... there's one in Marblehead, Massachusetts, of all places, right above the front door.
Yeah, yeah.
And
some of the big, massive ones were outside, too, in the elements. Yep.
Those seem to have been intentionally for the purposes of gracing department stores, music stores, grocers, parades, or places along a parade route, such as... there was one rather famous photograph of 202 Court Street in Portsmouth. It's about 8-foot monster eagle perched on top of this archway over a volunteer fire station. They're very rare today, though, because these things, after their use was over, they might have ended up on the side of a barn.
Right.
Very few. Right. I've only come across two in my research
mm-hmm.
That have survived into the modern times.
Yeah.
One is out at Chicago, and the other belongs to a private collector here in New England.
Now, I had the opportunity to grow up in the general area of Kittery and Elliott, Maine, and that whole area, and being in the antique and auction business. And so I've had a lot of connections with Bellamy pieces over the years, and also George Wasson and Spinney and those other carvers.
Yep.
It's a little difficult sometimes to tell Wasson apart from Bellamy. I mean, Wasson was pretty good.
Wasson was one of Bellamy's best friends. He was part of that circle, that cabal of summer visitors who like to hang out in Bellamy's workshop.
Yeah.
Including Mark Twain, William Dean Howells, Winslow Homer.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. These guys all came to the Kittery area to spend their summer vacations. And
mm-hmm.
Somehow, don't know how this happened, but Bellamy's workshop became the de facto, the place to hang out. It was like a pseudo gentleman's club. So that was, this is where they like to loll in chairs, smoke cigars, and talk about anything and everything.
Yeah.
And they also like to go yachting in Bellamy's yacht, which was this surf boat
mm-hmm.
from South America that he got his hands on. And it was rather famous in local waters because it had this outrageous paint scheme on it. So everyone knew Bellamy's boat when he was out there.
Yeah.
So he'd go careening around local waters with these guys. But Wasson was introduced to his group around 1881.
Mm-hmm.
Wasson moves to the area. William Dean Howells is Wasson's next door neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
So Howells looks him up and down and says, "Hey, you'll do. You'll be good for the crowd." And he and Bellamy hit it off.
Yeah.
They both have a similar nautical background. Both growing up in shipbuilding communities,
mm-hmm.
And of course they're both artists. Wasson is a painter,
mm-hmm.
but it's from Bellamy that Wasson learns the art of wood carving. Wasson, there's a absolutely priceless piece. It's a carving of an eagle by Wasson, and he wrote on the back, "First attempt," and he gives the date in February of 81. And the darndest thing is that It's a dead ringer for a Bellamy.
Yeah,
it's a good thing he signed
first
it.
First one. Wow.
His first one.
Now, yeah. I've been, I think, we talked before the recording. I've been in Wasson's house.
Mm-hmm.
His great nephew owned it. Saw all kinds of stern boards in there, and I believe there was an eagle or two, but I can't remember for sure. Wasson's paintings on the Bellamy carved frames or Wasson carved frames, I've had a number of those, and they always sell for a lot of money, and they're absolutely beautiful. What's the word on that as far as who did the carving of the frames?
It all depends on which one you're holding in your hands. It seems that originally Bellamy is carving the frames. And I shouldn't call them a frame so much as a board. It's one solid piece of wood.
That's right. But it looks like a frame.
It looks like a frame because the center is flat and that's what Wasson paints on. So at first it looks like Bellamy is doing the carving.
Mm-hmm.
But then remember, Wasson is learning from Bellamy.
Yeah.
So Wasson eventually starts carving his own. And have found examples of that, of both, where it's a Bellamy carving with a Wasson painting, and then a Wasson carving with a Wasson painting.
Yeah.
Fun thing about those, they're mainly for tourists, it seems.
Is that right?
Yeah, they were just...
And they were absolutely beautiful. I had one of Whaleback Light, and sure, like there were coastal scenes usually.
Yep. Usually it's you'll see a brigantine or a little tugboat or a schooner or something.
Yeah.
But they always have Whaleback Light or Fort McClary, one of the real obvious, landmarks of the area in the background the tourists will immediately recognize and gravitate to. And they're the perfect size. They're easily transported and explains why they're so darn, they're all over the place. I mean, they really migrated pretty far across the country.
Yeah. Oh, yes. So, yeah. I read George Wasson's book. Did you ever get a chance to read that?
Sailing on the Penobscot?
Yes.
Okay. That's a classic.
Yeah. And did you read the part in it where he says that he was commissioned to do one painting and he got so frustrated that he jumped through the canvas?
Yes.
And you know what? I had that painting.
Did you not?
He never jumped through it.
So why'd you make up that story then?
I don't know. And
it was a steel-hulled warship, if I'm not mistaken.
That's exactly right.
He wasn't familiar with those forms, so it didn't come out well.
Yep. It was hanging right in a house in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. I had read the book, and then I went back and forth and back and forth, and I had advertised that and put it in my auction, and the people wanted crazy money for it and never sold it. It's still in the house somewhere in Portsmouth, as far as I know.
Oh, geez.
Yeah.
But he never jumped through it.
He never jumped through it.
Why make up that story then?
I imagine he was just totally frustrated with painting it, but it survived.
I'm sure. I mean, his background was he was all about wooden ships. He had been raised around the boatyards again of Medford, Massachusetts, and spent some time up in Thomaston, I believe, too. So he was always familiar with wooden vessels and their forms and lines. So when those steel-hulled warships started coming out, this was newfangled territory for him.
Yep.
So I can understand why you get all upset about it.
Well, I think anyone that likes to do any type of artwork always kind of has a tough time with a commissioner if they're not used to doing that type of work.
And it's
when
hard
they have to do a work or they have to, Let's talk a little bit about Spinney. Mm-hmm. Now, I know very little about I know he was later.
Yes.
And I know very little about him. I did sell a door that he carved because he lived in the house, and it was sort of Bellamy-like carved, raised work on this door. And his eagles sometimes do fairly well.
Yep. Ivar Spinney was a native of the Portsmouth area. He had actually served in the United States Navy during the time of the Boxer Rebellion. Mm-hmm. And Spinney, he's there at the end of Bellamy's career. Mm-hmm. One of the funny things, and then he continued to carve after Bellamy, of course, passed. When it comes to Spinney, he's a great example of those of several artists in the area, woodcarvers, that were cashing in on the popularity of the Bellamy Eagle. These guys were intentional, just like you have Gucci and Gucci knockoffs. These guys were the Gucci knockoffs, the Bellamy knockoffs, if you will.
Yeah.
They really were, because Bellamy had so popularized that design, that these guys started to go ahead and they started to make their own either intentional copies of Bellamy, or in the case of Spinney, why I really enjoy Spinney's work is he took it in different directions. I mean, he did make direct intentional copies that tried to mimic Bellamy, but he also took the theme of the eagle with the shield and he in the abstract properties, and he would take it in new directions as well that Bellamy had never attempted or dreamt of. It has caused some confusion over time because some folks think they have a Bellamy when in fact it's a Spinney.
I
would love to have a Spinney in my collection if I ever get the chance to, but there's nothing wrong with a Spinney. It's beautiful work. Absolutely beautiful.
Right. Now, were there other people in his day, or is basically Wasson and Spinney the only two that really...
Oh, there are several.
Oh, there are several, those are the two that are mostly well-known.
Yep, those are the most well-known. There's a gentleman named John Pridham.
I never heard of him.
Yeah, he only made about 30 or 40 copies. And generally, when it comes from the examples I've seen of his work, John Pridham's eagles, they don't have that upward swoop. Mm-hmm. They're parallel to the lines of the back of the eagle, of the 2 foot wide wing assembly. Captain Adams and his son Cass Adams. Captain Adams actually piloted the last gondola on the Piscataqua River.
Really? Wow.
That was his big claim to fame. He's the last gondola captain.
Mm-hmm.
But Captain Adams also bought a Bellamy Eagle and used it as a template so he could make his own copies. Mm-hmm. And Cass would paint them afterwards. Mm. So they're quite close too. They have fooled eyes in the past. People have been like, the paint scheme, it's a different color palette, and there are certain the neck is too bulbous towards the bottom. That's one of the dead giveaways on an Adams. Mm-hmm. So we have those fellows. Walter Ketzler is another fellow. He came a little after Bellamy. Mm-hmm. He was a soldier in the Prussian Army during World War I, and when the war's over, comes over to Portsmouth area. Did a lot of great interior decorative painting, historically accurate treatments. I think he worked for Strawberry Bank, amongst other places. But he catches the Bellamy bug, and mm-hmm. so sometimes people show you a Ketzler eagle, and it's like, yep, that's nice. But and then to make it even worse, Ketzler or Ketzler's son had students. So you have a copy of a copy of the original. So you get three generations almost of people making duplicates. So you have Ketzler's making copies of Bellamy eagles, his son's making copies of his father's eagles, and then his son's teaching people. So
you know, I got to tell you, my grandmother was in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, mm-hmm. and she went to some class years ago and carved a Bellamy-style eagle.
It was probably Walter Ketzler or his son.
She didn't do a very good job. Sorry, Grandma.
Well, I'm sure she's looking, you know, down on you, and she forgives you. It's not her fault, because Walter wasn't that good either.
Well, that's really funny.
Again, these are the kind of things that can fool an untutored eye.
Yes, Going back to Bellamy, mm-hmm. let's just say the standard two-foot eagle that you see mostly mm-hmm. out there. Has anyone ever tried to do an approximate count of the body of work that he did?
If they were to try to, it would be a fool's errand.
Yes. In the thousands?
Easily. Yeah. One thing folks need to realize, when it comes to these eagles, there's a lot of mythology about them. People will tell you that he mainly carved these for barter. Now, it's true.
Yes.
He did barter some of them. Mm-hmm. It is true. But that's not why he's carving them. Mm-hmm. Generally, these are just, if he had a neighbor who was getting married, I need a wedding gift real quick. Oh, here you go. Congratulations. Mm-hmm. Maybe amongst friends and neighbors, he might use one for barter. The truth of the matter is, they were actually the cornerstone of a very successful business.
Mm-hmm. What about the rumors talking about barter?
Yeah.
I remember being a little kid and hearing the story that John Bellamy carved eagles for a bottle of wine.
Yeah, that's
or for
a myth.
Booze.
It's a myth.
Is it a myth?
It's a complete myth.
And so they kind of dirtied his name through this myth, really. Well, I mean, sort of.
Yeah, it does.
They paint him as more or less a drunk, you know?
When it comes to Bellamy, you touch on something that really needs to be addressed. I'm glad you brought it up. Mm-hmm. Bellamy and alcohol. I wish I had a nickel every time someone told me that Bellamy was this hopeless drunk, this town lush, falling all over himself. Mm-hmm. The stories are outrageous. I mean, they paint him as this two-fisted brawler, this guy who's passed out drunk across the street from his house under a big oak tree. And of course, like you said, that he's going ahead and he's heading over to, because at the time, Maine is a dry state. So the story was he would, whenever he was feeling a little thirsty, shall we say, he would sit down at the bench, he'd bang out a bunch of eagles, tuck them under his arm, go across the river, and he'd go door to door at the grog shops of Portsmouth exchanging these eagles for alcohol. It's a great story. It's very entertaining. You can see why it's so long-lived. The reality is very different, though. Bellamy did have an issue with alcohol. It goes back to 1857. He's a young man. He's courting a local Kittery girl. He asks for her hand in marriage, and she rejects him. He takes this news very badly. He does turn to the bottle for solace. He becomes a regular haunt in the saloons, in the billiard halls, in the beer gardens of Portsmouth, where he was living and working at the time. But he turns his life around mm-hmm. with a little help from his father. His father sends him to a place called the New Hampton Literary Institute. It's a school that's still standing today. It was a college preparatory school. But it was also kind of a de facto reform school for the wealthy families of New England. Hmm. If you had some money and your son or daughter had gone a little wayward, you'd send them to New Hampton. It was in the middle of nowhere. It still is in the middle of nowhere today. There's a gas station about a mile down the street, and that's about it. Mm-hmm. So you'd send them there. It was also a Free Will Baptist school. So these kids can't get into trouble. They are in the middle of nowhere. There's no saloons, no billiard halls. They're getting bombarded with a good heavy dose of that old-time religion every minute of the day. Mm-hmm. And after 2 years there, he comes back to Portsmouth. And he is, by all appearances, clean and sober. Mm-hmm. He opens up his shop at Daniel Street. Then he's down in Boston. Then he's working for the Navy. And it seems that he's clean, if you will.
Well,
and,
you know, I mean, it would be hard to imagine how he could put out such a body of work,
exactly,
as beautiful as he did, if he was under the influence of alcohol.
Well, that was the first thing that made me look into that and say, this doesn't sound right. How does a man produce so much with such beautiful grace and with those bold, crisp, clean strokes if he's supposed to be half in the bag all the time?
Yeah.
It seems that in his later years, when family members are dying off, friends are dying off or moving away, Bellamy does gravitate back towards alcohol. Mm-hmm. There are two instances of him having been arrested for public drunkenness in Portsmouth in the 1880s. But the funny thing is, only two. Many of his neighbors are getting arrested on a weekly, monthly basis over in Portsmouth. Yeah. So only twice, so it's not as bad as people make it out to be. He was also a member of two very interesting organizations. The first was a group called the Knights of the Maccabees. The Knights of the Maccabees were a fraternal organization, and one of the stipulations for membership is that you could not manufacture nor could you partake of alcohol.
Huh.
So
he was a member of that.
Yep. And he was a member of a group called the Washingtonian Inebriates.
Oh, yes. I've heard of them.
Yeah. They're a precursor to Alcoholics Anonymous.
That's right. Yeah.
And so he's, so it seems
that was a real big movement at one time.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you're talking about a time when, there was a lot more alcohol in our beverages back then.
Oh, absolutely. People don't realize that. And I sometimes think I should do a show about this because alcohol was huge in the 18th century in New England.
Absolutely.
I mean, it was like people would drink rum instead of water because they said the water was not good, so they had to drink alcohol, and they'd start first thing in the morning. Oh. You know, they were building their houses and doing their crops and everything.
Oh, they believed you couldn't raise a barn or build a house without actually having some fortifying beverage.
Yeah.
I think they did an estimate where the average American in the 19th century, if you were to take all the alcohol they're consuming and remove all the other stuff, just look at it's 2 gallons of pure undiluted alcohol you're putting in your body every year.
Oh, wow.
Some outrageous amount that would like kill a horse.
Well, you know, I know we're totally off subject here, but I did an auction years ago, the Josiah Bartlett signer of the Declaration in Kingston, New Hampshire. And I read through his journals, and I read also that he would buy a keg of rum. It was like every other day. It seemed like he was buying it. I don't know if it was for neighbors or what, but that was a big thing. You know, alcohol was a big thing in the past.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so by the time you get into the 19th century, you start to see reform movements because there's the realization of how damaging this is being to society.
It was all through Europe and everywhere. There was all kinds of reform. I forget what they call that.
It was generally, they call it the temperance movement.
Yeah, the temperance movement. I actually have an early plate, transferware plate, that says sobriety and something like that. It's pretty cool. Yeah. Yeah. So I know we're totally off subject and we'll get back to Bellamy, but it's sort of related to the stories you hear over the years.
It ties in. He's part of that whole environment, if you will, where the alcohol was much stronger than anything anyone's drinking today. I mean, this stuff could strip the paint right off your car. I mean, this was heavy stuff.
Yeah.
And so it seems that throughout his life, he struggled. I mean, it's a struggle he largely overcame. If he hadn't overcome it, we wouldn't be talking about him today. He would just be this backwoods whittler who no one really remembered.
Yeah.
But because he was able to go ahead and largely remain sober, if you will, and he was able to keep his focus, keep his bearing, that's why we're sitting here right now chatting about the man.
Yep. Now, one thing I want to ask you real quickly is a lot of times when you pick up a 2-foot Bellamy, you turn it over, he countersunk the screw, and he put a little piece of paper glued over the hole.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know why he put the little piece of paper over the hole?
Ah, if only those little pieces of paper survived. They always
you can see the glue mark. Yeah,
it's probably various labels. I did find one. It wasn't over that hole, but it was for the Manhattan Storage and Warehouse Company. It gets back to the output. Mm-hmm. Bellamy is producing these and filling orders for several hundred at a time.
Wow.
Yeah, and I found one reference for an order for 500 that he filled, another for 700, 250. He's filling these out for, well, a lot of them are going right over the river in Portsmouth. And this this ties into alcohol, too, strangely enough. One of his big, big patrons, one of his first investors when he starts his Eagle business, is a gentleman named Frank Jones.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Frank Jones Brewery, yep.
Exactly. Frank Jones Brewery, the brew king of Portsmouth,
yep.
Produced a number of ales and other items. Frank Jones is using Bellamy's Eagles as promotional giveaway gifts.
Really?
If you go into your local bank today, you get the nice little calendar around Christmas time. Uh-huh. Jones would do that with Bellamy's Eagles. That's why you find ones that say, Merry Christmas, you know, Happy New Year. So Jones is purchasing these from Bellamy. That's why you get this connotation that, Bellamy is giving them from barter. It wasn't Bellamy. That's a story that comes along later after Bellamy's dead. It's to explain why so many bar rooms have Bellamy Eagles in them.
How about that? How about that?
Yeah. I just found out there is a bar room up in Portsmouth today that still has a Bellamy Eagle in it.
Wow. Wow. I mentioned early before we started recording that my father had seen the workshop, the tools and blank carved eagles that were sitting in a nail barrel. They were just all stuffed in there. Yep. They weren't carved, they were just roughed out. Have you ever seen any in that order where they were just roughed out and not carved?
Strangely enough, I haven't. There's been a lot of tantalizing leads.
Yeah.
The closest I've come is actually a series of heads by Captain Adams, who I mentioned earlier,
yeah,
the fellow from the Gundalo, which is great because you can see the progression of how you'd make a Bellamy Eagle.
Yeah,
I would love to find where your dad sent all those eagles. The Peabody Essex, I should also mention, they have his toolbox, and they do have two heads in that aren't completed. Mm-hmm. It's just representational smattering, though. As to why you'd have a whole bunch banged up, remember, he's making them, several hundred per order. Bellamy's workshop, he actually referred to as, quote, a snug little factory.
Yeah, it was very small, wasn't it?
It was very small. It was an old counting house for Sir William Pepperell, who was a merchant in the Kittery area. Mm. Bellamy and his family lived in the Sir William Pepperell mansion. Which is still staying today, private home.
It's a beautiful
absolutely
place.
Gorgeous.
Yes.
You had the good fortune
to be inside. Oh, yes, I've been in it many times. Yeah, I knew someone that lived there. Yeah.
Beautiful home.
Yeah, yeah.
And so out in the back, it's now their guest cottage, but you have this beautiful counting house, which was a dockside business office pretty much back in the 1700s, 1800s. And so that's what Bellamy converted into his workshop, specifically the second floor facing towards the harbor. And you can still see traces that there were wood carvers or used to be working in there. There's this gorgeous, gorgeous, tiny little half model of a schooner hull that is actually carved into one of the frames of the windows up there.
Wow.
And it's a schooner hull design dating from Bellamy's time.
Ah.
So you know that he's the one who put it up there.
Wow, nice.
It's a beautiful little spot, and that shop he's working there. He's not the only one working in there. We find business letters from Bellamy personal letters, where he's talking to his father and his brother Elisha and Charles, and he's promising them, hey, if you need some work this winter, you can work with me.
Hmm.
And so they're in the workshop during times when their business is slack.
I see.
Go ahead and helping them bang these out. And it seems he even had some apprentices from the neighborhood working in there.
Wow.
And as to what they're doing, well, this explains why he has these patterns. These you see a bunch of these over at the Farnsworth Museum up in Rockland, Maine. If Bellamy's there just by himself, he doesn't need these patterns. But when he has apprentices helping him out in times of high demand, they need the patterns. That's what your father probably saw in that. That's what you saw as well in that nail barrel. The roughed out versions were the ones that the apprentices cut. They're using scroll saws. Mm-hmm. They're just doing the basic shape, And then Bellamy comes in, he does the fine detailed work with his chisel, like the eye, the feathering, etc., the tongue. But the basic form of those pieces, especially the poles and the banners, I mean, that's being all cut out by the apprentices.
Wow, wow. A listener always wants to know this. I think it was Ron Borgio, or who had the record for the highest selling?
That was Ronnie. Ronnie sold one of the most beautiful eagles I've ever laid my eyes on. It's an eagle plaque. It's a little bigger than your usual Bellamy, but it's not one of those big monster ones, the 8, 10, 12 footers. Mm-hmm. This sucker's about, I want to say, about a good 4 or 5 feet in width. Mm-hmm. The banner says, "God is our strength and refuge." Original paint job, and I don't think the sun ever shined on this until it came into Ronnie's hands.
Is that going to be at the exhibition?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
It's in the exhibition and the book.
Oh, okay. So we're going to talk about both that as we end this out. Sure. And what was the price of that? Do you remember?
$666,000 plus.
Wow. Isn't that amazing? That is totally amazing. I mean, when I was young, in the 1970s and 80s, $500 was a Bellamy Eagle, a two-footer. And then I remember when they hit 10,000, and then a couple of them, there was a while there, they were going crazy, and now they kind of died down a little bit as far as values go.
It seems that the cooling off came hand in hand with the economy.
Yes, like so many parts of this business.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I think, honestly, if our economy ever truly improves, if we ever really get things going again, I think you will see in your lifetime a Bellamy Eagle price snatch a million. I'd like to think
that. Yeah, that very same one that brought the 600,000 could certainly go through and top a million.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
If it went today, it could, because people are spending crazy money on the very best today.
And that piece is the best.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't deny it.
Yeah. Once again, just for the listener, I want you to say what the exhibition is called and where it's held and when.
The exhibition is called Bold and Brash, The Art of John Hilly Bellamy. It's being held at Discover Portsmouth, which is the gallery space for the Portsmouth Historical Society, and it's opening on April 4th of this year, 2014.
And you're the curator there for this, curator.
Yep, guest curator for the exhibition, author of the book.
Someone can actually meet you there at the opening, is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yep. I'm going to be up in Portsmouth a lot this summer. We're going to be doing a large, this is really the summer of John Hilly Bellamy, if you will, for Portsmouth. We're going to be having I will be there for the opening on the 4th, of course. On the 5th, we have a lecture and book signing taking place. Mm-hmm. And then we're going to have a series of lectures throughout the summer with myself and other experts in the field of Bellamy, American wood carving, his work for the Masons and other secret societies, all kinds of stuff we're going to be having there. So every Friday and Saturday, there's going to be something going on related to Bellamy, as well as carvers like Artie Swanson and others will be doing live demonstrations, workshops.
Yep.
So it's
great. Wow, that's wonderful.
Yeah, it's pretty exciting.
Richard, Richard Candy has a lot to do with this.
Oh, if without Dr. Candy, this wouldn't really have happened.
Yeah, great guy.
Amazing fellow. For your listeners out there, Dr. Candy, Professor Emeritus over at Boston University, who now is one of the big driving forces behind Discover Portsmouth, tied in with Portsmouth Historical Society. Richard was an amazing help. He did the content editing on the book, and opened my eyes to some things that I hadn't been aware of, such as the Adamses and their work on Bellamy.
He's kind of carrying on in a way. I think of Joe Copley, and he did so much for Portsmouth, and I think that Richard kind of follows that line. He's doing so much for the historic preservation.
Oh, absolutely. I mean,
and Sawtell, you think of Sawtell and people like that. Mm-hmm. They've all done a lot.
Yeah, he is definitely carrying forward that tradition, if you will. And I think he was the one who saw the value of the book, because the book is being published by the Portsmouth Marine Society. Hmm. So he saw that, you know, this was just a natural. This is a great way to go ahead and to reintroduce and bring the level of scholarship on Bellamy up to the next level.
Yeah, great. Yeah. All right, so thanks so much for joining us today. This has been a real pleasure for me, because I really love these eagles and the whole story of Bellamy, and it's been a lot of fun for me. Thank you.
Well, Martin, the pleasure was all mine. Thank you for having me.
This podcast is sponsored by WorthPoint. Find out what your antiques are worth at worthpoint.com.